If a frozen pizza is baked, boxed, and sold in Ohio, but like 60% of its raw ingredients were grown overseas, the US government officially considers it a foreign import. And keeping that specific pizza out of your local middle school is about to become a massive bureaucratic headache. Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Thanks for having me.
Today, we are unpacking the hidden machinery that dictates exactly how millions of dollars are spent to ensure American agricultural dominance right there on the classic school lunch tray.
Right. And the source material for our analysis today is actually a really detailed, rigorous video training module.
Yeah.
It was designed specifically for K through 12 school nutrition staff. And it breaks down the USDA's recent massive overhaul of the Buy American compliance rules.
Specifically, the final rule that took effect on July 1st, 2025.
Exactly. It takes something we generally think of as very straightforward, you know, just buying food for kids.
Right.
And it reveals this intense, granular regulatory framework that's operating behind the scenes.
Imagine you are a school procurement officer trying to feed thousands of students across an entire district. Or, you know, maybe you're just a curious taxpayer wondering how international supply chains impact a local middle school cafeteria. Okay, let's unpack this because the sheer scale of what we are talking about is staggering.
Oh, absolutely.
This compliance is completely mandatory for the National School Lunch Program, the School Breakfast Program, the After School Care Program, and the Fresh Fruit and Vegetable Program.
Yeah, we are talking about billions of dollars and millions of meals served every single day across the country. It is a massive market lever.
It really is.
Though it is crucial to establish the boundaries of this rule right up front. This strict regulatory umbrella applies specifically to those core federal programs.
Ah, right.
So it does not apply to, say, smart snacks sold in vending machines or a la carte items or any meals sold completely outside of those specific federal programs.
Oh, so if a student buys a random bag of potato chips from the hallway vending machine, the government isn't like legally tracking the origin of those specific potatoes.
Right, exactly. They don't care about the vending machine chips.
But for the core lunch tray, you know, the chicken nuggets, the scoop of green beans, the carton of milk, the rules have fundamentally changed.
Yes, they have.
And before we can even get into how schools are restricted in their buying, we have to start at the very foundation. We have to define what makes a food item legally American under these new 2024 rules.
Which is trickier than it sounds.
Right, because you would think domestic just means it comes from the US, but it is far more complex than that.
Way more complex. The new regulations establish a very specific legal threshold called the 51% rule.
Okay.
It is a two-part test, and a food product must pass both parts to be considered legally domestic. Part one dictates that over 51% of the agricultural commodities in that product must be grown domestically.
Okay, but how do they practically measure that? I mean, if we go back to that frozen pizza example, are they weighing the cheese against the tomatoes?
Well, they literally are.
Wait, really?
Yeah, the rule dictates the measurement is strictly by weight or volume of the agricultural commodities.
Wow.
So a manufacturer has to break down that pizza. They look at the wheat in the crust, the tomatoes in the sauce, the dairy in the cheese. If over 49% of that total weight or volume comes from foreign farms, the entire pizza fails the first half of the test.
That is wild. I keep picturing this like a group project in school. You know, when you have a group project and one kid does all the formatting and printing at the very end, but the other kids did like 60% of the actual research?
That's a great way to look at it.
Right. So if a food product is manufactured and processed right here in the United States, so the final assembly happens here, but the majority of its raw ingredients are imported from another country, it completely fails the test.
What's fascinating here is how intentionally strict that two-part test is designed to be. Because the second part of the rule requires that the product must also be processed in the United States, which, by the way, includes U.S. territories.
Okay, so it has to be both grown mostly here and processed here.
Exactly. The USDA is actively preventing a massive loophole. Without that dual requirement, a multinational food distributor could import huge quantities of foreign agricultural commodities, say, I don't know, tons of tomatoes and onions grown in another country.
Right.
They could ship them to a facility in Ohio, chop them up, put them in a jar, and slap a domestic label on the salsa simply because the final processing happened on U.S. soil.
Oh, I see.
So the 51% rule by weight or volume ensures that the actual farmers, you know, the people pulling the raw materials out of the dirt here, are primarily American.
And there is a very specific card out mentioned in the training for fresh, which seems to really double down on that concept.
Oh, yeah. The fish rule is a perfect example.
Right, because fish and fish products have to meet that same 51% domestic standard, and they must be processed in the United States.
The fish rule really highlights the administration's goal of protecting the entire domestic supply chain.
Yeah.
You cannot just catch a fish in U.S. waters, freeze it, ship it overseas to be filleted and breaded because the labor is cheaper there, and then bring it back for Fish Stick Friday.
Right, no outsourcing the middleman.
Exactly. The processing has to remain within the borders or territories. It forces distributors to use American processing plants, sustaining jobs locally rather than offshoring the middle steps of food production.
That makes sense in theory, but let's think about the practical reality of feeding kids.
Sure.
A 100% domestic food supply year-round for thousands of schools across radically different climates in the United States. I mean, that seems impossible.
It is impossible.
Right. You cannot grow fresh strawberries in Maine in January. So the USDA has to allow for some foreign food, right?
They do, yeah. Since a fully domestic supply is not practically feasible across all seasons, the government allows for a specific amount of foreign food.
Okay.
But they are slowly tightening the leash. They are instituting a phased-in non-domestic purchase cap, which limits the maximum percentage of a school's total commercial food expenditures per school year that can be spent on non-domestic foods.
Here's where it gets really interesting. They aren't just setting a permanent limit. They are actively squeezing that cap over a six-year period.
Yes, they are turning up the pressure.
Starting July 1st, 2025, that cap is set at 10%. So 10% of your total commercial food budget can be foreign.
Right.
But then in 2028, it drops to 8%. And finally, in 2031, it drops to a strict 5%.
Which is a huge shift.
Let's ground those numbers in reality. If a local school district spends $100,000 a year on commercial food, their allowance for foreign goods goes from $10,000 in 2025 down to just $5,000 in 2031. Over a whole school year, serving hundreds of kids every day, $5,000 is practically nothing.
It's really not.
It barely leaves room for essential foreign staples, let alone fresh produce out of season.
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, you can see exactly what the USDA is trying to engineer here.
Right.
They know that dropping the cap to 5% overnight would completely collapse the school food supply chain.
Right, chaos in the cafeteria.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Schools simply wouldn't be able to feed the kids because the domestic infrastructure isn't there yet to replace every single foreign import.
Ah, so it's a transition period.
Exactly. By phasing it over 6 years, from 2025 to 2031, they are forcing a gradual but inevitable shift in long-term agricultural supply chains.
Mm.
They are sending a massive market signal to food distributors, essentially saying, you have 6 years to find American farmers to supply these goods, or you risk losing your billion-dollar school contracts. It allows the market time to adapt rather than shocking the system.
Just to clarify the math for anyone trying to wrap their head around tracking all this, the compliance is based on annual totals, not individual transactions.
Yes, that is a crucial mechanism.
Right.
A school district could theoretically buy a massive shipment of foreign bananas in January when domestic fruit is scarce.
Okay.
And as long as, by the end of the school year, all those foreign purchases combined don't exceed their percentage cap of the total commercial food budget, they remain compliant.
Oh, that makes sense.
It gives procurement officers a tiny bit of flexibility to manage those seasonal shortages.
The training also mentions some exclusions. USDA foods, which are foods provided directly by the government to the schools, and non-food supplies like, you know, napkins, cleaning chemicals, and plastic trays, those do not count toward this cap calculation at all.
Right. The cap applies strictly to commercial food expenditures. But even with those exclusions, I mean, managing a shrinking percentage is going to be incredibly difficult when faced with real-world market constraints.
Okay, so the cap shrinks to 5%. But what about ingredients that literally don't grow in the U.S., like certain spices or olive oil?
Yeah.
Does a school just stop serving anything that requires them? Or is the government making them burn their tiny 5% allowance on black pepper and vanilla extract?
Well, to handle those items, the government utilizes a master document called the Federal Acquisition Regulation.
Okay.
This is essentially the massive rule book governing how the federal government buys everything from office supplies to fighter jets.
And it applies to lunch, too.
Yes. Within that regulation, there is a non-available articles list, often just called the FAOR list. It covers items that naturally do not grow well or at all in the United States. Things like bananas, olive oil, and various spices.
Oh.
So for items on the FAOR list, schools require absolutely no exception documentation. They don't have to prove they couldn't find American olive oil because the government already acknowledges it is scarce.
Okay, skipping the paperwork is great, but I noticed a wild paradox in the rules here. Yeah, even though arborless items require no exception documentation, their actual cost still counts toward that shrinking non-domestic cap.
Yep, that's sketch.
How is a school supposed to balance that math? I mean, if they are forced to buy foreign spices because they don't grow here, and that purchase eats away at their 5% allowance, how do they have any room left for anything else?
You've hit on the exact administrative burden these nutrition directors are facing. Buying AVAR list items saves you the paperwork, but it severely penalizes your budget cap.
That is rough.
What this does is force a rigorous, almost ruthless level of critical thinking at the district level. A procurement officer has to look at their upcoming menu and realize that olive oil and necessary spices might eat up 2% of their 5% non-domestic allowance right off the bat.
So almost half of it is just gone on the basics.
Exactly. Really? That leaves almost zero margin for error on produce and meats. They cannot use their remaining cap on foreign apples just because they are slightly cheaper.
Right.
They have to aggressively save that cap for the things they literally cannot get here.
It turns a local menu planner into a macroeconomic strategist.
It really does.
And for any foreign item that isn't on that FAR list, what happens? Because there has to be some mechanism for when an American product is just outrageously expensive or completely unavailable.
The regulations do account for this through a strict list of exceptions. But, and this is key, the list is incredibly short.
How short?
There are only two valid exceptions allowed under the new rules.
Just two?
Just two. Exception number one is the price exception. This applies only when the non-domestic product is significantly lower in price than the domestic alternative.
Okay, that makes sense.
And exception number two is the availability exception. This kicks in when a product is simply not produced in the United States in sufficient quantities or of satisfactory quality to meet the school's needs.
I have to bring up a detail from the source material that made me laugh.
Oh, the taste thing.
Yes. The training module actually tests the nutrition staff on this specific scenario. They explicitly state that student taste preference is absolutely, unequivocally not a valid exception.
Yeah, it is a very polite, bureaucratic way of saying the USDA does not care if the middle schoolers prefer the imported brand of crackers.
Sorry, Timmy. Your refined palate does not override federal agricultural policy.
Huh, exactly.
If the kids are staging a riot in the cafeteria over the new off-brand American crackers, the school just has to tell them to take it up with the government.
Pretty much. If an American farmer grows it and the school can afford it, they are buying it, regardless of the cafeteria reviews.
But for those two valid exceptions, price and availability, how do they prove it? Because effective July 1st, 2024, the source notes, there are four specific categories of documentation required.
Right.
Solicitations, contracts, food products received, and exceptions.
Yeah, and rather than just looking at it as a pile of papers, think of those four categories as a chain of liability.
Okay, how so?
Well, the school starts by explicitly writing the Buy American provisions into their solicitations and contracts. Then the offerers, you know, the company is actually selling and distributing the food, they must legally certify the percentage of U.S. content and provide the country of origin.
Ah, so they put it in writing.
Exactly. If a distributor secretly swaps American apples for foreign ones to save a few bucks, that certification paper trail protects the school and puts the legal target squarely on the distributor.
That's smart.
And, by the way, even third-party management companies running cafeterias have to completely comply and provide this documentation.
Okay, so the contracts protect the school on paper, but what about when the food actually arrives?
That's where it gets intense.
Let's look at the rule for USDA foods. The training states that for non-processed USDA foods, they must be entirely grown in the U.S.
Right.
If a delivery truck backs up to the school loading dock and a non-compliant product is sitting on that pallet, the school must refuse the delivery and report it immediately. Wait. You're telling me a cafeteria worker has to turn away a truck full of food at 6 a.m. if a label is wrong? How are they supposed to feed the kids that day?
It essentially turns the school cafeteria loading dock into a strict border checkpoint.
That is wild.
It completely shifts K through 12 nutrition staff into the role of compliance auditors. The person receiving the food cannot just count the boxes and wave the driver through. They have to verify the country of origin on the label before they sign the manifest.
Because if they don't...
Because once they accept it, it hits their cap or puts them out of compliance entirely.
So if you refuse a delivery, you might be short on food for that day's lunch. But if you accept it, you violate federal procurement rules. The pressure is unbelievable.
Which is exactly why the USDA heavily emphasizes the use of tracking systems.
Oh, they have software for this.
They provide an optional exception tracking form, but schools can use their own equivalent procurement software. The key is that these auditors, the nutrition staff, they must constantly calculate their non-domestic spending in real time.
So no end-of-year surprises.
Right. They can't wait until May to realize they blew past their 10% cap back in November. They need immediate visibility into their spending margins every single time a truck arrives.
Let's play this out in reality. What happens if a school district tries their absolute hardest?
Oh.
They update their contracts, they train their staff at the loading dock, they do all the math. But because of severe supply chain issues in their specific region, they simply fail to hit that initial 10% cap when it kicks in next year in July 2025.
Yeah.
Are they immediately penalized and stripped of their funding?
This raises an important question about the friction of implementing massive systemic change.
Mm.
The USDA knows this transition is going to be incredibly difficult for some districts. They aren't trying to punish schools that are genuinely trying to comply. So they have built in a temporary accommodation process specifically for school year 2025 to 2026.
For a safety net.
Precisely. If a school district cannot meet that 10% cap, they must submit a formal request to their state agency.
Okay, so they get a pass.
Well, not exactly. They can't just throw their hands up and say, it was too hard. They have to meticulously demonstrate good faith efforts.
Ah, and the source actually outlines exactly what those best practices for a good faith effort look like.
Yes, it's very detailed.
You have to prove you updated your solicitations and contracts. You have to show you actively tracked all non-domestic purchases, including those FAR list items we talked about.
Right.
You need organized exception documentation, an active tracking system, calculated current spending, and like proof that you actively worked with your distributors to try and confirm domestic origin before giving up.
Exactly. If a district can prove they did all of that heavy lifting and still fell short, the state agency can grant temporary permission to exceed the cap.
Oh, that's good.
More importantly, they will provide technical assistance to help the district get compliant for the following year. It is a necessary acknowledgement that this transition is going to be messy.
Yeah, undoubtedly.
State agencies are likely going to be very busy playing catch-up, helping struggling districts untangle their local supply chains to ensure the ultimate goal, you know, feeding the students, doesn't fail while the administrative process is mature.
I just wonder how many schools are going to be scrambling for that lifeline in 2025. It feels like a massive wave is about to hit the shores of every school district in the country.
It will be a heavy lift, for sure. But the technical assistance is there to bridge the gap between policy ambition and operational reality.
So what does this all mean? We started with a simple nostalgic lunch tray, and we've uncovered a massive regulatory engine.
You really have.
We have a strict 51% definition of what is legally American, measured carefully by weight or volume and requiring U.S. processing.
Right.
We have a non-domestic spending cap that is shrinking from 10% down to a tiny 5% by 2031.
Yes.
We have only two exceptions: price and availability, and a strict chain of liability that turns cafeteria workers into supply chain auditors at the loading dock. And we have a temporary safety net for 2025 to keep the system from breaking while everyone adjusts.
It is a profound shift in agricultural policy.
Hmm.
And you know, even if you don't work in a school cafeteria, understanding this is vital.
Absolutely.
It shows exactly how massive federal procurement rules are used as levers to shape the broader agricultural market and protect local economies.
Yeah.
When the government leverages the buying power of thousands of schools, it literally changes what farmers plant in the ground and what distributors keep stocked in their warehouses.
It really does. And I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over.
Okay.
Fast forward to 2031. That final 5% cap has hit. Schools are essentially locked out of the international food market, aside from the barest necessities. Consider how that restriction might fundamentally force school menus to change across the country.
That's a great point.
Right. With such a tight leash on foreign imports, Will cafeterias be forced to abandon certain international recipes entirely because the domestic ingredients are too scarce or too expensive? Or will this spark a massive renaissance of highly localized seasonal cooking in American schools, where a cafeteria in Maine serves a completely different, locally sourced menu than a cafeteria in New Mexico?
It is a fascinating proposition. It could entirely redefine what we consider cafeteria food over the next decade.
The next time you see that classic middle school lunch tray, you will definitely know just how much weight it is really carrying. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the hidden world of school food procurement.
It's been a pleasure. Keep questioning what's on your plate.
We will see you on the next deep dive.